The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm Fabian Charlton.
And I'm Jason Hosking.
Welcome along, guys. Thank you very much for joining me. Now, Fabian, you're a bit of a tech enthusiast with a pretty broad knowledge across the consumer electronics world, aren't you?
Yeah, so I follow along with what happens through technology. I see what's happening through other tech sources like The Verge and what's happening out there and just post about it.
Yep. Well, thanks for coming on the show. And Jason, I wanted to get you back on the show. It's been a little while since we last chatted with you. Been quite a while, actually. But you've recently been awarded by New Zealand Geographic the Photographer of the Year for 2015. So I thought it would give us a little bit of an excuse to have a bit of a chat to you around technology in the world of photography. And as Fabian's also sort of into video, so we may merge in and chat a little bit about video. But yeah, during the show, we'll dive in on that. But let's get started with the topics of the week. Now, first up, interesting confirmation today that Apple are ready to launch their iPad Pro here in New Zealand. So that's going to be available for pre-sale in New Zealand, I think, from Wednesday, and we'll see it in the stores later on in the week. Apple actually haven't given an exact day, but I think Thursday or Friday that'll be available. And the timing is curious because it actually lines up with when Microsoft are launching their Surface Pro 3 here in New Zealand and in Australia. Surface Pro 4. Thank you, Fabian. I need somebody who's sharp to correct me. So, the timing there sort of overlaps. And of course, it tends to be Apple that will get most of the attention around a product launch and most mainstream media. So it'll be curious how Microsoft go. And of course, in Australia, they're also launching the Surface Book, which won't be launching here in New Zealand. It'll be curious to see how that works out for Microsoft. All right, well, that's kind of the big products coming through this week. Now let's jump in, Jason, and I'm kind of curious to hear a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing recently. There was a book project that you were shooting for around the country. What was that one called?
That was Wild About New Zealand.
Right. So that was there was a TV series, and then you did all the photography for the book that was published alongside.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I guess you do a whole range of projects, but one of the things that helped you sort of get picked or tapped as the winner as Photographer of the Year was because of your use of technology, and in particular, drones. I'm kind of curious, you know, what was the technology like when you started doing photography, which must be over a decade ago now, compared to now? What has sort of been the big changes?
Yeah, I probably started in the mid 90s in the darkroom, black and white darkroom, and I'm very nostalgic for those days. Yeah, technology is great, but there's a lot about that I miss.
Technology is often like that, isn't it? It sort of can, you know, we lose something as we move to all these new bits and pieces of technology, and you know, certainly all the interruptions and so on that technology brings compared to the simpler life that we used to have without technology. But I mean, it's certainly there's been some good sides to it, right? In terms of, I mean, when you were shooting on film, that would have been a pretty expensive process to, you know, if you wanted to shoot a couple of hundred images. I mean, I guess you were just a lot pickier, right, when you were shooting on film because it was so expensive and so time-consuming if you were processing the film yourself or whatnot?
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, there's good things about that as well. You know, you slow down and you take your time more. But no doubt technology has made things, it's just opened doors that give us incredible opportunities that we'd never had before, unless you had a lot of money.
But even, I mean, you talk about the sort of the time, and you did have to sort of slow down because when you were taking a photo that was going on to film, I mean, you would take that shot, you'd you wouldn't actually, you know, especially of a long exposure or, you know, all the varying sort of settings that you would do, you wouldn't know actually what that was going to look like, you know, perfectly until you got it processed, right? Whereas now we, you know, we close the shutter on the camera or, you know, press the button on our iPhone and, you know, you can see the result instantaneously.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I really miss about film is there were these things, you know, photographers call happy accidents.
Yes,
you know? And,
yeah.
And you'd kind of come, go to the lab expectant to look at your work and you'd find stuff that you're just like, oh my God, I didn't realize I caught this. And then sometimes you'd be scratching your head like, what did I actually do there? And this would actually lead on to other, you know, that would help innovate and create new techniques with some people. And yeah.
So, yeah, I guess much harder for that to happen now and much more predictable. I mean, once you've got a photo usually stored in there is a whole bunch of data about, you know, settings and so on that were used as well, right? So it's easier, you know, once you learn how to do a particular exposure and so on, I mean, you could do the same thing again a minute later, depending on lighting and all those other things that might be changing.
Yeah, and in the old days, you would just, you would test stuff and you would spend a bit of money running tests. So if you had a big advertising job, you know, you might spend 2 days prior to your shoot day testing. Guys I used to assist with would frequently do that kind of stuff, and there would be money in the budgets for that. So on the day, you get everything's kind of exact. But yeah, no doubt with digital technology now and photography, it's just made life much easier in lots of ways.
Mm.
So it's pros and cons really, but mostly pros.
Cool. Now, I mean, tell us about the book you did, the Wild About New Zealand one. What was that like in terms of shooting that? And, I mean, you must have taken a pretty large number of photos over, well, how many weeks or months were you on the road to shoot that?
I was on the road for about 4 months.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly how many shots I took.
But, I mean, it would have been well into the thousands, right? I mean, it was quite, because over that sort of period.
Yeah, and the nature of the job is an editorial job, so it's a book project, so you're just covering off lots of things.
And how did you store all of that data? Because, you know, when was this, 18 months, 2 years ago? So you weren't able just to, you know, find somewhere to upload them to some online cloud storage and so on. I mean, you would have been, there would have been a level of risk in terms of your data and so on that Absolutely. You were shooting, and a lot of data, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a national park, so often you'd be in places where there was no reception at all. And yeah, so essentially it's just, you know, backing up onto a computer, making a backup of that and then a backup of the backup.
Yeah, okay. So you were pretty wise in terms of retaining your data there.
Yeah. The other thing I did was because I was in an old van as well. I partway through that project, I would post hard drives back to myself in Auckland.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because, you know, the thing went up in flames, and all my backups are in there.
Yeah, well, you were driving a funky old combi van around,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah, well, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it looked good in some of the photos I saw, but I guess not the most modern piece of auto technology.
No, but that was a sweet thing about it.
Yeah.
It was cool. Very, very retro styles. It was great.
Yeah. And now with this recent work you've been doing, you've, you know, because I've seen, you know, some of your photos from both from the book and so on, and quite often you're, you know, you've got aerial shots that are maybe shot from an aeroplane or a helicopter, but now the world of sort of drones is starting to open things up. What has that meant for you, and how does that sort of facilitate your entry for the New Zealand Geographic Awards this year?
Aerial work is something I've always really loved. When you're an assistant, you know, you're living on the smell of an oily rag. You have no money to do that kind of thing. So there were occasions where I'd be working with a photographer and we'd be flying around in choppers and things like that. And those, this is back in the film days. And so a lot of those flights, it was just head down rolling film.
Right,
so,
right.
So you'd miss a whole lot of stuff. But you, on the way there and on the way back, you'd see stuff. And I guess that and taking flights around the country and overseas, yeah, I've just always loved the perspective from, you know, a seagull or, you know, bird's eye view looking down. So for me, I saw drones technology. It's certainly not a new thing. I remember probably 5 years ago seeing that kind of stuff and just going, wow, this would be awesome. But the cost of that was pretty astronomical.
Yeah. As tends to be the case with sort of professional equipment and also with technology when it's new, right? And then the prices sort of start moving down.
Yeah, yeah. And so probably a couple of years ago now, I happened upon it by chance again and realized that the cost of this stuff had come down astronomically. Still expensive, but just a lot more affordable and into the realm of possibility. And yeah, so I just started looking into that and it's been an interesting journey.
Cool, cool. All right, well, great to chat about that, and hopefully we'll keep hearing from you of you know, where the technology helps you get. But you know, ultimately, it comes down to the creativity, doesn't it? It's, I mean, the technology just tools that help, but the creative aspects are really the unique that I guess each photographer or filmmaker sort of brings to come up with the results,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting now because access to, you know, both video and still photography equipment, you know, it's much easier because we've got, you know, everyone's, you know, got a camera in their pocket and so on. But, you know, it still seems to be there's a you know, few people that have got their real creative talents that are still those that really get drawn on for you know, for the best work. And I guess it's awards like these that sort of help highlight who are the best in the country. So I hope this award is something that does well for you sort of career wise. And yeah, we'll look forward to hearing more in the future. Mm-hmm. Now let's jump into some of the other topics. We wanted to chat actually around smartwatches. We had an email in from one of our listeners. This is Cameron Farquhar, who is based down there in the Kapiti Coast, Waikanae. And he was saying he is he's quite keen to upgrade his smartphone and is sort of curious about what the best options are in terms of smartphone and smartwatch combos. And, you know, his comment, he was quite curious around Huawei Nexus and the Huawei watch combo, and was just sort of, you know, curious in terms of what were the best options. And in his case, he was saying that Apple possibly out of his price range. So I thought maybe we can just chat through some of the varying smartwatches on the market. We've all had a look at a few of them. Fabian, what is it that you wear?
So currently I'm wearing the LG G-Watch R, which is a pretty good option as being a circular smartwatch with a great screen. It's got a good battery life on it as well with a leather strap. It's water resistant to a degree, so I take it in the shower and wear it and take it everywhere, and it's pretty much sweet.
Not too much of a problem. Now, I had somebody commented after maybe it was last week or the week before the episode when I was talking about good battery life on a smartwatch, and we were talking about Samsung's new Gear S2, and they sort of made fun of me because they highlighted the fact that, hey, the Pebble Watch has a much longer battery life than you know, most every other smartwatch, which is, you know, is a fair point. There are some, you know, some watches that do operate quite differently. There are, you know, other ones that'll do a level of fitness tracking and so on. That can run on a single cell and last for, you know, weeks or months. So, you know, I guess it is worth pointing out there is some variation there. And probably one of the biggest shortcomings, I think, of smartwatches at the moment is that need to sort of charge them every night. I mean, how do you find that? Do you always remember to charge your smartwatch, or do you find some days you've missed out?
I've forgotten a couple times, but it does last like an average of 2 days, depending on how hard I use it and how I use it and what I use it for. But usually I charge it up at night before I go to bed, and when I wake up before I go to work, I take it with me, and it goes behind my computer, so, you know, just charge it up and off I go.
Yeah,
okay. But with the Pebble watch, because it's a like an e-ink screen, so it's got a really special screen on there which uses as little power as possible, it can last longer than what most other screens for smartwatches do, so it has got that sort of functionality behind it. So it's kind of like you get extended battery life out of a Pebble due to what the screen is versus, you know, what you get on a Samsung smart watch or an LG or an Apple watch.
It's interesting. And the other ones that will tend to last longer are the likes of Fitbit, which, you know, are very much focused on the fitness side. Now, Jason, you spent a bit of time with an Apple Watch recently, and, I mean, you're a pretty big fan of the Apple products. I don't think you run anything in terms of your phone, laptop, and so on that's not Apple and probably haven't done for a long time. How did you find the Apple Watch?
I was really curious to see what it was like, how I actually found it. I was a little bit disappointed. Battery life, you know, it would maybe sometimes not even last an entire day, depending on what you were doing with it. I was figuring stuff out, so I was probably chewing out more battery than a regular user maybe.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting, but for me, it's not something I don't wear a watch anyway, so...
It would be a change for you to have to start wearing a watch, and it didn't do enough to sort of jump out and make you think, I need to have this now.
It's definitely not something I need. It has some interesting features, but a lot of that's just connected to your phone anyway, so I can't see... I mean, if you've got to carry your phone around to get some of this stuff, I don't quite understand the point.
So a bit premature from your perspective, or do you think it'll never be of interest?
For me? Possibly in the future, but yeah, not right now.
Yeah.
But like when you're taking photos using a camera or, you know, using a phone, it'd be nice to see, you know, what the time is without having to go through the settings on your iPhone or having to check it. So you can just bring out your watch and, you know, off you go, you check your time, cool, it's this time, and then you keep going.
Oh, I just hit the home button on my phone and tells me the time.
So I mean, different strokes for different folks. I think, at the moment, there's a huge amount of product that's coming onto the market. So, of course, you know, we've got the Apple Watch with Watch OS, and, you know, certainly iPhone users, that is probably going to be, you know, the pick for most people that are already on Apple. But most of the other products now are compatible with Apple. Samsung...
Sony.
Samsung's devices that have run on Android Wear, they're compatible. So really anything that's Android Wear will.
Yeah.
Microsoft with their Band and Band 2, those are compatible across Windows Phone as well as Android and iOS. Pebble certainly... works across Android and iOS. And then there's a new one announced today, the Tag Heuer Connected.
Which is a pretty interesting, like, premium watch. Like, versus you have premium phones, so you have, you know, your smartphone, which is super premium, ultra specs, and then you have Tag, who's just brought out this new watch with a great screen, titanium casing, rubber sort of band, so it's a really, like, premium-looking watch.
Rubber doesn't sound premium to me for the band.
Well, for the price, though?
$1,500 US. That's probably... there aren't a whole lot of more expensive smartwatches on the market, but it's a Tag. So, you know, for the money, I guess, it's probably going to be something that they'll sell out of. Now, Fabian, you were saying they've just produced a very small number of these initially. It's just they're just doing a short run?
Yeah, so they're doing a short run of about 1,000 models. So they start shipping, or they start pre-orders this week, and then they start it next week in Europe. So 1,000 models being sold, which is tiny. But then they've also said it's future-proof in some way, so you can buy the smartwatch version, in a couple of years' time, you want to upgrade it to a mechanical watch, just pay out the $1,500 and off you go. You get a mechanical watch.
So right.
It's like buying another watch.
So you'd be able to get a refund if you want to step up to a...
No, you have to pay another amount. So
you're Yeah, but if you're... Well, they're giving you $1,500 off the new tag?
No.
Oh, you're paying $1,500 more?
Yeah, so you pay another watch worth to have it upgraded to a mechanical watch.
Right, which I'm sure is a discount on what it would normally cost you. So, yeah. Oh, it's interesting. Yeah, so, it's definitely, there's a few products on the market. I think at the moment, it very much comes down to, it's probably either you're an early adopter if you're wanting to buy a smartwatch, or you're really keen on those fitness aspects.
Yeah.
And there are lots of fitness, devices from Fitbit and TomTom and Garmin and so on. Microsoft Band, which is sort of, I guess that one straddles the two, but not available directly here in New Zealand at the moment. And then, all of the other products that are Android based or the Apple Watch, which tend to include the fitness elements to them, as well as the standard sort of smartwatch features. So, in terms of giving advice, I think the thing to look out for is probably the newest products. So, the comment there in the email from Cameron, he was considering the Huawei Nexus 6P handset and a Huawei watch. That's probably a pretty good combo.
Start with
not a low cost item. When you put those two, or a low cost purchase, but putting those two together, you got something fairly nice.
Yeah.
But for those that are just wanting some sort of wearable and maybe with a focus on fitness, it's well worth looking at those fitness devices. And some of those now will also bring through the notifications off your phone. So if you want to get something that's sort of buzzing on your skin or giving you alerts, then that's probably a reasonably good approach.
Just start with a good smartphone, just something kind of high-end to premium. So the Nexus range is really good. It runs on virtually stock Android, which is a great operating system for most smartphones today. And then have a look out there at what's happening for the smartwatches. Every 6 months, they're going to change. If you want a really high-end smartwatch, LG's got great options. Huawei's got great options. Samsung's got a really nice-looking watch with its cool like clicky sort of wheel around it. Apple watches don't work with Android, but Android watches work with Apple, so have a look at what's out there and read reviews. And
No doubt we'll be seeing a few more probably announced in the CES time frame, Consumer Electronics Show, which takes place in Vegas in January, so there'll be a whole bunch of announcements around wearables there. Now jumping on to a local story, we just got news through yesterday that Vodafone are spending $22 million to upgrade their cable network. Now, this is the network that was originally, I think, rolled out by, what were they called, Saturn back in the day, and it was for delivering cable TV, which was something we never had in New Zealand. We had satellite TV from Sky, and then the cable TV network launched. Of course, now it's part of Vodafone. They acquired that as part of their Telstra Clear acquisition, and that has delivered broadband in the Wellington, Kapiti Coast and Christchurch regions now for quite a number of years. And although it has actually come under a bit of flack in recent times because they have had some network issues in terms of actually delivering the sort of performance that technically their network was capable of, there were some bottlenecks that they've been working through and trying to address. So instead of just addressing those things, they've also announced that they're moving to gigabit speeds over that cable network. So I think that's going to probably please a bunch of customers. Interestingly, though, in most of those areas where they have their cable network, of course, there is the government's ultra-fast broadband initiative in play. Mm. So what that will do will just stir up a bit of competition between Vodafone's own network and the local offerings on the ultra-fast broadband. But getting gigabit internet speeds to your home is it's probably never a bad thing. Jace, would you be keen on these sorts of internet speeds if you happen to live in one of those locations?
I'd be pretty happy with that.
Yeah.
Especially because it's running down copper. versus, you know, having to have fiber lines run through, which is taking its time to roll out at the moment. So
yeah, well, the cable network that was rolled out, I mean, it was in some ways was a little bit like the UFB rollout. It was a pretty big project to get it out there. And so we've got, you know, the traditional copper lines, we've got the cable network, and now the fiber based, and each, you know, one of those has been done independently. Now, thinking about 1 gigabit speed, Jason, would you find this useful personally?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be great.
So what would it allow you to do if you could get this, you know, for uploading your data, or, you know, what would you do with it?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is 4K video streaming, you know, watching Netflix, stuff like that.
Oh, so just the fun stuff. But work-wise, it would be useful for you to, in terms of, you know, uploading to the cloud and so on, right? From, now,
yeah, from a business point of view, no doubt, that would be very cool. At the moment, I don't do any cloud backups. It's just I have VDSL, so I just don't have the time to back up the gigabytes of data that's needed.
Yeah. I guess it's certainly a constraining factor. And, you know, I guess those that are sitting in Dunedin listening to this will be, you know, chuckling away because they've already got their gigabit speeds at the same price as everyone else is paying for their standard ultra-fast broadband. But for the rest of the country, I think the promise of gigabit speeds is something that we're all looking out for. And, you know, whether that comes via the ultra-fast broadband network, which is, you know, probably how the large majority of people will get it, or through this channel. I'm pleased that, you know, Vodafone are keeping their network up to speed. They've done this deal for $22 million with Huawei. And we understand this is the first network of its kind, running the latest generation DOCSIS technology, which allows them to use the cable network in that way and actually get that gigabit speed out of it. So, yeah, for those that are sitting on one of those Vodafone connections and maybe have been getting a little bit frustrated about the slower speeds, I imagine Vodafone are hoping that you will you'll hold on for a little bit longer and stick with them for gigabit when it launches. I think it'll start becoming available mid-2016, so it's still a little way off. Now, one other topic. Last week we spoke a little bit around Microsoft's OneDrive, and that, you know, they announced just over a year ago that they were going to offer these unlimited cloud storage. And I'd asked Microsoft, and the only thing I'd heard back from them was around the fact that they were progressively, you know, going through and doing this, but I hadn't, you know, ever come across anyone that had this unlimited cloud storage. So to me, it didn't really seem as though it was a real thing. Well, what came out last week was that Microsoft had given some people the unlimited cloud storage, and as everyone, you know, anyone would imagine, of course, if you give that out, then some people are going to try and test it and see, well, what does unlimited mean? And what resulted was, you know, some people putting up, I think in one case about 74 gigs worth of 74 terabytes worth of videos and content, which, you know, shouldn't be any sort of surprise to Microsoft because they had offered an unlimited plan. And you know, whether somebody programmatically filled up their storage or, you know, actually put real data in there, you know, exactly what one, you know, any right-minded person would expect in terms of launching a service like this would happen. And of course it did. And then what happened pretty much actually around the same time we recorded last week's episode, and we were challenging Microsoft on where's this unlimited storage, they put a blog post online basically saying that, hey, we're no longer offering this unlimited storage, and sort of blaming it on those who chose to take advantage of the fact that it was unlimited storage.
Yeah.
And of course, they hadn't actually rolled it out to, as you know, as far as I'm aware, you know, a huge number of people. So, yeah, kind of curious. So they've really pulled back, and they're also pulling back on the amount of free cloud storage that they give. So they gave away any consumer could get 15 gigabytes of free storage, and then there are other ways that you could get, you know, bonuses to bump that up a little bit more. And Microsoft have just pulled that right back to 5 gigabytes. So this is kind of curious. Fabian, what cloud services do you use?
So I'm a bit of a Dropbox fan at the moment, with having an HTC phone. So when I originally bought my HTC phone, it came with 30 gigs of Dropbox storage, and ever since then I've been using it. So putting a bit of money into it and having Dropbox storage is quite nice. Just back up a computer or whatever you want.
And that's how it often works, isn't it? You start on one service and you'll stay using it. Now, what I'm curious about, you know, I'm not quite buying into, you know, Microsoft's panic and surprise about somebody using a whole lot of storage being, you know, a valid reason why they should cut back. You know, I am kind of curious about all of their reasonings. I don't think we know exactly how much market share they've got, but I'm sure that they understand this is going to limit how, you know, their growth of market share going forward. But yeah, in recent times, their product has been, you know, up there as one of the better products, but probably hasn't had the same attention of Dropbox. And that I think would have left them behind the eight ball a little bit. And then Google Drive as well, which has been very popular. Jason, do you use any of these? Do you use Apple Cloud Storage? Or
yeah, I use Dropbox as well. I've got Google Drive, but I just found they're clunky compared to Dropbox. And I'm on the Pro plan, I think. It's $100 a year or something.
And that gives you, what, a terabyte or something?
That's right. It's but that's fantastic. It works flawlessly with the Mac and just all my devices, and I'm really happy with it.
Mm. So I'm just curious. Yeah, Microsoft obviously have a strategy here. They know this is going to impact their success. So it's curious. Do they think they're just going to get enough business, just the fact that it's built into Windows now? Are they not really interested in this consumer space because Microsoft makes, you know, a very large percentage of their revenues out of businesses, and the revenue that they earn on this sort of thing, particularly if people were uploading 74 terabytes worth of information. You can imagine this not being very profitable to them. So maybe they're just making a change and they're just going to focus on where the profit is. And they might well figure that, if Dropbox wants to, try and make money out of cloud storage for consumers, then good luck to them. And, they're not going to play the game of giving away so much. That said, Dropbox are the guys that give away, I think, 2 gigs for free as standard. So, you know, the it's 5 gigs amount that they've gone down to is still better than what you get standard from Dropbox. So it's a bit of a curious move, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but then there's also mega.co.nz. They used to offer, 50 gigabytes as you're starting?
That's right.
Which was a huge amount for free, you know. And then you could upgrade your plan to being how big you want, depending on how many people you want to use it. So cloud storage, 5 gigs is plenty. 2 gigs is enough for some photo sharing. Google Drive is 15 gigs, I believe, which is,
And it's shared with your Gmail and so on as well.
Yeah, so you can upload documents to it. You can upload all your Word documents, music and everything, and you can share it between your contacts on your email.
And but both of you are paying for cloud services, aren't you? Neither of you are just using free services, or you use a mix?
I use a mix between them. So. Yeah,
but you do pay for some Dropbox now, and so do you, Jason, right?
Yeah, my Dropbox service is paid for.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that is becoming more and more common, as that people will actually pay for these services. So the impact of this may be maybe lesser than what we expect. But it's a rather curious move from Microsoft, I've got to say.
One thing I find kind of frustrating, as I've got access to so much data, if I want to share that with someone who only has a 2 gigabyte account, say I'm sharing a folder that's 4 gigs, Dropbox
penalizes you there, right? It doesn't work if the other person doesn't have the right account.
That's right.
And I guess that's part of their model for monetizing, and that it doesn't work if everyone involved isn't on paying plans. So it's a very good way to basically force everyone that's wanting to share data to ultimately being on a paying plan. But it's not going to work in every situation, but I'm sure that's part of their upsell process.
But how trustworthy is cloud storage, like versus having something on your hard drive or your computer at home versus having it on the cloud? When you look back at what happened to iCloud being hacked and photos went everywhere, like how can you trust what's happening with the cloud storage places? Like here in New Zealand, we have an IBM cloud storage place down in South Auckland, and how can you trust the security of that place to be the best it can be?
Well, that's a good question, actually, Fabian. I think we'll find that what you get between a consumer offering and a business offering will be different. So if you're paying for a premium, business offering, whether it's something from Microsoft or from Amazon with your S3 and so on, or whether it's some sort of consumer oriented offering, there will be different ways in which they store the data and replicate the data and protect the data depending on what it is. From the consumer perspective, I think a lot of that comes down to education as much as anything else around how we store passwords and using different passwords for different services. So that there's probably a lot of risk there where consumers will use the same password on lots of different services. And I saw somebody raise their hand there. I'm not going to say who it was. So there are those sort of bad habits that we'll often, tend to have. And then one service that we use gets hacked. They haven't been as diligent as they should have been in terms of how they've stored their passwords. So somebody is actually able to get in and reverse engineer those passwords and then publish them online, and they get applied across varying services. So that's that's often where the big risk is your own personal data. Unless you've got it locked down with two-factor authentication and so on, then there's a reasonable chance somebody might get at that at some stage. So you have to put some protections in place or just be wise about what you store, right? And that's why there's been a lot around, storing naked pictures and things like that. If you store that stuff, you just have to be prepared. It might end up online one day. And so there's those considerations, and then for businesses, it's not just about the protection of the data. It's also about, from a security perspective, but it's also about, what happens if that data center goes down. So is the data replicated in other locations? And, Jason, you were talking about that earlier with your photos when you were tripping around the country and how you had three copies of that data. And, I think that's, businesses expect to have those multiple copies in multiple locations. And you went to that effort for you as a one person business. You think of the level that bigger businesses want to go to, and those options are in many cases are available to them. But it does depend on which services they're using. And within my business, we've certainly come across organizations that are using cloud services in some way that maybe have let them down, and it's a matter of finding that right fit of the service, the security that it provides, and also the protection of your data. So, it's not always maybe as quick and easy as it looks to decide on what the right choice should be. But in most cases, I would say putting data in the cloud, if you're really diligent around your passwords and those sorts of things, is probably going to be better off than you just leaving it on a loose hard drive sitting somewhere. That'll be my pick at this stage anyway, but yeah. There are all sorts of layers and levels you can go to, and Jason's example with making sure there were hard drives in different places and so on, effectively that's what you end up with a cloud service, although there's a few more layers of protection there with RAID systems and so on to protect the data. Now, one more thing I wanted to chat about before we finish up this week. Last week we had Will Fleming on the show, and he gave us a few details about his new podcast, the My Kiwi Life podcast. And just wanted to thank all the listeners that did get a chance to download that and have a listen. A bunch more episodes coming through soon. In fact, there's a second episode online already. But thanks again everyone who did download it, because that hit top 10 on iTunes charts in New Zealand last week. So, we're really, really pleased with that that podcast launch. And we've got a few more other podcasts coming out over the next, hopefully, few weeks, but certainly over the next few months. And one thing I would like to ask of listeners, if you've got a moment and you do either use iTunes or an iOS device, if you could give us a rating on iTunes and a review, that is that's always very, very helpful to us. So if you've got a quick minute to jump in there and rate us or review us, that would be greatly appreciated. All right, well, that really covers us for this week. That's all our topics. So thanks, gents, for coming on board. Jason, how do people track you down if they're interested in booking the country's top photographer at the moment?
Probably just through my website, www.jasonhosking.com.
Cool. And you're on Twitter as well? You do a tweet from time to time?
Very seldomly on Twitter. I'm pretty... Instagram, I'm pretty regular on that. So yep. That's Jason Hosking.
On Instagram. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Yeah, well worth following on Instagram, actually. I quite enjoy seeing some of your new pics come through. And Fabian, are you on social media somewhere?
I'm on Twitter and I'm on YouTube.
What's your Twitter handle? That's probably easiest.
At @obscgr1, @obscgr1. So, excellent. Just hit me up and
that's great.
Talk tech and it'd be sweet.
Good stuff. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. You can get in touch with me, Paul Spain, on Twitter. Feel free to add me on LinkedIn. If you do, just maybe put a little note in there letting me know that you're connecting via the podcast. Thank you to one of the listeners that pinged me on LinkedIn this week and was very complimentary of the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Called it the best podcast in Australasia. So very flattering. So, of course, I was going to accept that request. So keep those lovely comments coming. So you can track me down Twitter, LinkedIn, those sorts of things. And you're welcome to email me, paul.spain@podcasts.nz. All right, that's us. Thanks, guys. Catch you next week. See ya.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast. Brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.